Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm joined by Dr. Phil Manning, one of our Chapel Hill Great Science writers, and we have the privilege of talking to Jonathan Alderfer, who is the author of The Kid's Bird Guide to North America. Phil, welcome.
Thank you.
And may we call you Jonathan?
Yes, please do.
That's great.
DJ.
Both
DG.
No, you can go anywhere you want to on that. Well, Phil is active in the Audubon movement and is a science writer, so he's just really excited about having the chance to visit you and talk to you about birds. But can you start off telling us why we needed a kid's guide to birds when you've written maybe hundreds of other books? Are you've written a whole lot of other books.
It's the same. Hundreds, but you know, we do have a series of bird guides for grown-ups, for adults, and we just we realized we have a kids book publishing division at the National Geographic, but we realized we don't have a dedicated bird book for kids. And I remember when I was growing up, you know, I struggled with a grown-up bird guide. Eventually, I got the hang of it, of course, but you know, having something that could turn kids on to birding and bird watching through a book, we just said, you know, that's a natural. We got to do this.
How did you approach writing for writing and organizing and illustrating for kids versus what you have done
well,
so many times
you
for
know,
adults?
Our bird guide, like our main bird guide, covers all of North America, covers every species of birds in North America, which is close to 1,000 nowadays if you count all the rare birds. And so we needed something that would introduce kids to birds at a more manageable level. So we decided a good way to organize it would be by habitat. So we chose 10 habitats, and some of them are pretty obvious, like backyard east, backyard west. But we also have things like farms and fields and, you know, deserts, prairie and plains, river and marsh. So if a child is looking at this book, probably the place they're going to start is their own neighborhood. And so hopefully you can find a habitat out of one of those 10 if you're a kid starting out, and look at those and try to learn something about those birds that you might be seeing right around your house.
Yeah, Jonathan, I don't know about kids exactly how they would start, but I started with the rock star birds myself.
Oh, you went, that's at the back of the book.
That's right. Yeah, well, I'm interested in rock star birds, you know. I thought it would really be cool. I really liked it, by the way.
Yeah, we have a rock star birds and we have international rock star birds.
Yeah, too, right.
So. I think kids might gravitate towards that too. You know, that's some of the most exciting and colorful and, you know, sometimes weird and beautiful. Yeah.
Well, I was particularly interested in the illustration of the harpy eagle. I had actually seen a harpy eagle once.
Wow. Now, that's a hard thing to do.
It was. We were just cruising along. We were in the Amazon, and somebody saw one up in a tree. They stopped the boat and sat there and watched him for 30 minutes.
Those are the birds for the listeners that don't know what a harpy eagle is. It's one of the largest, if not the largest, eagle in the world, and it... It flies through the jungle, rainforest, and picks off things like monkeys and sloths. So it carries quite large animals back and eats them.
Yeah, right.
This is funny. I mean, you start talking about the gruesome stuff, and you say, "Oh no, not for kids." But that, when you start talking like that, that's what the kids love, is when there's something
eats them up. You know, another bird that kids probably love, and most kids are aware of now, are snowy owls, because they're in the Harry Potter movies.
That's true.
You know, they use those owls in the movie. I don't really recommend this particularly, but they had the owls as the messengers, carried messages in the Harry Potter movies.
Well, you mentioned this. I don't want to get too far off the topic, but but do we have those owls here? In, or have they're only in Europe, or where?
No. The snowy owl is what they call a whole Arctic species. It breeds in the northern hemisphere. Usually stays in the Arctic area, but in winter, they move south looking for food. Usually, it's young birds that move south, and you're in North Carolina. I don't, you know, you've probably had a snowy owl at some point, but it would be a very rare occurrence in North Carolina.
Yeah, we did see one year. This is, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. It, believe it or not, was in the parking lot of a marina. Now,
wow.
What he was doing, I have no idea. I didn't actually see him, but a lot of people did.
He was delivering a message for Harry Potter, maybe. That was the
day.
Yeah, 2 years ago, we had one in downtown Washington, D.C. I guess it must have been feeding on pigeons or rats or something in the city, and it stayed for about a month. It was perched on various the roof of various buildings during the day, and you know, it obviously made a living in the city.
Well, Jonathan, you are Phil and I both noticed that you had written and assembled a guide for the birds of the Carolinas, I guess, or for North Carolina.
Right, and, we did. Well, that was an editor on that, but there was a North Carolina author. Gosh, I don't really remember his name at the moment, but I think I want to get it here. The book,
yeah.
I have the book right here. It was Lex Glover, who was I think he's a he was in the executive board of the Carolina Bird Club.
Well,
and he's more a South Carolinian than a North Carolinian, but he put that book together for us and did a really nice job on it.
Well, this is when you have the ability to focus on a small defined area, then you're more likely to have. When I read that book that you edited, mm-hmm. almost every bird that you would have in there would be one that I might have the opportunity to see. Sometimes.
That's right. That's right. Although this was a small book, that it doesn't cover every bird that is in North Carolina, because, as you may know, that birders are kind of interested in rare birds too. So that oftentimes what a birder really would like to have as a guide, at least after they become accomplished at it, is something that covers all the birds of North America.
Yeah, when they're into the when they've got their little list, Phil, I bet you've got one too of the ones that you've seen. When you get up in the hundreds, you're not going to be covered by just the usual book.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. And you know, that's part of the fun of birding. You know, it's sometimes I think it's a little like stamp collecting. You know, you're interested in what you haven't seen or don't have, and for good reason. I mean, it's fun to see a new species, because every species of bird has a particular, you know, way of acting and a niche that it fills and a song that it sings. So it's great to learn a new one.
Phil, you know that our state bird is the cardinal, and we think that's very special, but the cardinal is the state bird of a number of other states as well. And you you give great coverage, Jonathan, to the cardinal in the book. It's
right.
Wonderful. And what was your thinking about that? Was it just, this is something that every kid can see across the country?
I think we put it in the backyard east section, because it's often seen, you know, around houses in backyards. Doesn't occur in the all along the West Coast, for instance. But we tried to choose each habitat has 10 species that it deals with, but we chose 4. We didn't have room for more, actually, and we wanted to go in depth on some of these birds species. So we chose 4 for each habitat, and we have a 2 pages devoted to those species, and cardinal is one of them. So because it's kind of iconic, and like you said, it's the state bird of a number of states, and you know, it's probably one of the first birds than a lot of people learn.
I was just thinking about that. I'm not as adept in identifying birds, but boy, I love to see a cardinal. I mean, you love to see a bird that you do recognize. And
yeah.
The cardinal is, I guess, the one bird that, or one of the birds that is easily recognizable for lots of reasons, the color and the shape. And
right. Got a crest and the yeah. males are bright red. The females are a little bit less obvious because they're kind of a olive with some red tints to them, but they still have a crest.
Well, I don't want to get into trouble, but there's some men who like to brag about the cardinal as being the male being much uh-huh. more adorned than the female.
Well, you know, that's...
I believe we better take a quick break before I get into trouble. We're visiting with the author of the National Geographic's Kids Bird Guide of North America, Jonathan Aldifer, and Phil Manning and I will be right back with him after this short break. And we are back from our break. We're joined by Phil Manning, our local science writer, and I are having the privilege of visiting with Jonathan Aldifer, who is the author of the National Geographic Kids Bird Guide to North America. When we took the break, I was about to get in trouble about talking about one of the usual birds. What are the other usual birds that kids in North Carolina might see? I'm focusing on your backyard east section.
Yeah, well, let me open up. But, you know, just offhand, I would say, well, the bird on the cover, for instance, blue jay, is a common bird in North Carolina. I live not that far away in Washington, D.C. In fact, my daughter is graduating from UNC Chapel Hill next month.
All right.
For her. No. Well, tell us about her. Let's take a diversion. How did she happen to come to Chapel Hill?
You know, she wanted to go to a big public university, and rather than a small school, and you can't get much better than UNC Chapel Hill, can you?
Well, that we don't think so, but we're glad that somebody up in the northern part of the South agrees with us about that.
And well, it's a great school, and she got a great education down there.
She gonna be a biologist or ornithologist?
No, she's in languages and comparative literature, and she's actually become almost fluent in Arabic.
Oh, boy, wow. Good for her.
So she's got a lot of language skills, and we're very proud of her.
Well, that's terrific. You had experience raising kids, and did you mm-hmm. did were
you know, some... not every I know what you're going to ask.
Okay.
Not every kid, you know, gets excited about birds, and you know, she learned a lot about birds just hanging around my household, but. She's not a birder, and that's fine. She's got intellectual pursuits that are very different, and I support that. And you know, that's something that parents should take into consideration. You know, you as a parent might be really interested in birds, but you can't force those sorts of things on kids. So give them the opportunity to. Maybe have this book and look through it on their own and see if they get a spark.
Well, I guess where I was going, I'm excited about your daughter being in Chapel Hill and to have a celebrity send or allow his daughter to come to Chapel Hill. That's a big accomplishment for us, and we're excited about that.
Keep her away.
But as a parent who's respectful of the kids' individual right or responsibility to make his or her own choices about what, you know, what the interest will be. Still, as someone who had the interest in birds, you had to be developing tactics and strategies for saying, hey, look at that. Isn't that interesting? And finding out what kids respond to. And that must have had some kind of impact on the book.
Well, sure. You know, that's one of the reasons, for instance, you know, what Phil was saying, that he turned to the back of the rock star birds, and that's kind of one of the reasons we said, you know, we gotta get kids, you have to light the spark somehow, and that might, you know, what better than rock stars, right?
Yeah, I might say, Jonathan, the little squibs at the bottom of the species where you talk about, like, for example, with the snowy egret, the golden slippers business. That, to me...
Read it, Phil. What does he say?
I don't have it.
Oh, you don't have it?
I know what he says. He says that the snowy egrets have golden feet. You call them golden slippers. And
right.
In the book, he says the reason they do, or from an evolutionary point of view, would be because small fish tend to be attracted to the golden feet, and of course that's what the egret eats. And there were some others like that I thought were really, really, really interesting. The one about the house sparrows in Australia. I thought I knew most of that stuff, but I had never heard of that one. There's electric eye for
tell us the story.
Restaurant.
Tell
well,
us.
There's electric eye at a restaurant, and then the birds learn to go to where the electric eye was, to flap their wings to get the door to open so they could go into the kitchen and get scraps of whatever they were after and get back out. It was really cool. I mean, I like that a lot. I'm like a kid, I guess.
Story,
I mean, that's the kind of stuff I like. Yeah, it is.
Well, you know, we tried to do that throughout the book. There should be about 40 of those because each of the birds, each of the four main birds in the 10 habitats, we had a little, kind of interesting fact. It might be weird, might be unusual, might be something you'd never imagine, like that opening a door by flapping in front of an electric eye. So each of those species, the blue jay, it says, I can read it from what we have there. Just a frown or a smile lets you know how a friend is feeling. The blue jay's crest signals to nearby birds if it's relaxed or mad. When the bird is sitting on its nest, feeding its nestlings, or just hanging out with its mate or family, its crest is flattened. When it's feeling threatened or aggressive, the crest is held up. The higher the crest, the more agitated the blue jay. So, there's a little sort of tidbit of information about a bird you might see, in your backyard, and you can kind of tell how it's feeling or what its mood is by looking at its crest.
Sure. I mentioned one other that I particularly was interested in, and that was the kingfisher and how basically their territory is, instead of being an area, is linear. And if you ever go down through the Everglades, you'll ride along and you'll see a kingfisher up on a telephone or a utility wire. And you'll go, 300 yards, and you'll see another one. They're spaced out along the canal right below them. And their territory is longitudinal as opposed to an area.
Right.
And I really think that's cool.
It's a straight line along a river or a canal or something. Sure.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and they're very, very, very evenly spaced along certain places along the Everglades.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I bet that happens with kingfishers, just about everywhere. Unless they're living by a lake shore. But then they probably divide up the lake shores. So.
Yeah, probably. I think it's cool anyway. I enjoyed that a lot.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things to me were about the owls. And I'd always been interested and noticed the owl's ears.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned what children would learn is that those aren't ears.
That's correct.
I mean, how does that work? I mean, why do they have ear-looking...
Those are probably a little bit like the blue jay's crest. They're feathers. They're just feather tufts. They're ornaments, and they do. Sometimes you can see, for instance, a great horned owl with those feather tufts pulled back and laid flat, like when it's flying. Other times, it might hold them straight up. But the ears, owls' ears are kind of interesting because they're located. The owls have a facial disc. It looks like they have almost like a radar dish or something. And that's not a bad comparison, actually, because those feathers on that dish of the face kind of focus the sound waves. And their ears are located below their eye level in that facial disc. And I don't know if we mentioned this in the book or not, but the owls have sort of 3D hearing, because one of the ear openings on the one side of the face is lower than the other one, so the sound gets there slightly at a different time period. It's a millisecond of difference, but that allows them to sort of hear three-dimensionally, And you may have seen pictures of an owl, like a hunting in winter, and it can actually hear the sound of a rodent under the snow. So it doesn't even have to see it; it just hears it. Amazing, and can dive down with its talons extended and hit pay dirt under the snow that it couldn't even see.
Well, we need to take a quick break. Phil Manning and I are visiting with Jonathan Alderfer, who is the author of the National Geographic's Kids Bird Guide of North America. We'll all be back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm joined by my friend Phil Manning from here in Chapel Hill, and we're visiting with Jonathan Alderfer, who is the author of the National Geographic Kids Bird Guide of North America, and also the proud father of a
Tar Heel.
Of a Tar Heel who we expect to graduate in just a few days.
Yeah.
Jonathan, we're talking about owls.
Right.
And I run most mornings, sometimes through the woods, and every so often I encounter a bunch of crows who are all excited, and it turns out they're chasing down an owl. And You talk about that in your book. What's happening when I'm seeing this?
Well, it's called mobbing, and birds like crows, jays, even small birds, if they discover a predator, and particularly an owl is a good target, they chase it off. They get around it. They even get so close as to try to pull its feathers or peck at it. And even though they're a smaller bird, when they know where the owl is, they have the advantage because they're faster. And that's why you'll sometimes see a hummingbird chase a hawk. It's really the hummingbird's not in any danger because it's so much faster and more maneuverable. And it's better to know if you're a potential meal for a predator. It's better to know where that bird is and tell your neighbors about it, and or chase it off for that matter.
Yeah, I happened to see one yesterday, which was a mockingbird chasing a crow just running after him, running away.
Well, why are the crows after the owl?
At night, crows become dinner. It's not unusual for, say, a great horned owl to raid a crow's nest. Might even be able to kill an adult, but it certainly could take nestlings. That happened in my neighborhood one night. We have great horned owls here, and we have barred owls. And I think this was a great horned owl. There was a crow's nest in the top of a pine tree, and there was a terrible screeching, crying racket, late in the middle of the night. And the next morning, I went over to the bottom of the tree, and there were a couple of dead crow nestlings that I think the owl just killed them. It didn't even eat them. So they're kind of mortal enemies, is what they are.
This is destroying all of our images about the good old wise owl. So he not only would attack a crow's nest for a meal, he would just do it out of spite. I mean, out of meanness.
I think the probably the impetus was a meal, but I can't explain it. Sometimes that happens.
Another part of your book that interested me was your description of some of the invasive birds, and pigeons, starlings, others, which I thought you were very, every description I've heard it has been that these birds are just tremendous nuisances who crowded out our native species, but you seem to be kinder. Did you mean to do that? They're there and they're birds and.
Yeah, we're not going to get rid of them. Things like house sparrows and European starlings and those species are here to stay. And I think maybe the starling, for instance, it has a bad reputation. It nests in tree cavities, so it competes with native species for tree cavity holes, like chickadees or titmice or bluebirds. You know, that's a bad thing. There are ways to help that out by putting up birdhouses, for instance, that wouldn't let a bird the size of a starling get into the hole. But even so, that said, if you get a look at a starling, it's quite a beautiful bird. You know, it's this iridescent green and purple, and we have a really nice photograph of one in the book. It's on page, I don't know, it won't help your listeners, but it's on page 52.
We hope by now they will have all rushed out to buy the book and already have it available to them.
But, you know, it's a European bird, and it was introduced along the East Coast, spread over decades, spread across the country, even up into Canada, and it is a nuisance. Forms huge flocks in the winter sometimes, but you know, we got to learn to live with it.
I actually agree, 100% agree with that. I know I'm on the Audubon board here in North Carolina, and Audubon, like many many other conservation organizations, is very species oriented. They want to provide for species, but actually, birds, like people, are individuals. I mean, and as an individual, those birds have, in my opinion, have some rights, and one of them is the right to live, whether you're a starling or a pigeon or a harpy eagle. So anyway, I'm not going to preach anymore.
Well, you can preach a little bit, and Jonathan can chime in to agree or disagree with you about the birds management. One of the things that I think is interesting, and you deal with this a little bit in the book, is that we have migratory birds that we've domesticated that have become a little bit of a nuisance when they sort of decide to stay with us.
That must have been under the Canada Goose entry, because there are certainly the majority of Canada geese that we see in the lower 48 have turned into a term we use is called feral, which means they've adapted to a human sort of unnatural or human, at least human altered landscape. And so those Canada geese said, hey, the heck with flying to Canada all the way up to the Arctic, we're just going to stay here all year. And so that's why you see Canada geese on golf courses and reservoirs and, you know, in parks. And they're pretty tame, and they can even be a little aggressive sometimes.
Well, they can mess things up, too.
They poop all over the place.
And so, I mean, Phil has said that he believes that every bird has a right to live, and I'm thinking not the ones that are pooping around my pond.
Well, you can shoo them away if you want to, but, you know, I just don't think what I don't believe is proper is to prefer one species over another. When you're actually comparing not like, for example, rock pigeons versus some rare species, but I believe that if I was a rock pigeon, I would like to think I would have as much right to live as a golden-winged warbler. But a lot of people don't believe that, but I do.
Yeah. Well, I don't. I guess the hard choices come when you might be deciding where to spend money to conserve birds, and I think, Phil, you probably agree with me that the money that the government and the state spends to help birds survive should go to our native species that are imperiled.
Absolutely. I don't have any problem with that. My only problem is when we do something as detrimental to one species, like, for example, shoot them, and to protect or to increase the likelihood that another species is going to survive, that's part I don't care for.
Right, right. No, I'd agree with that. And, you know, it's... the starling is a lot of these birds are the introduced species are controlled, and even, believe it or not, some native birds are poisoned or shot because they become a nuisance, and Not sure they do that with Canada geese, although you can hunt Canada geese. But crows are sometimes, you know, become form huge flocks in the winter. They're sometimes controlled, which is a euphemistic way of saying killed by, you know, Fish and Wildlife Services.
That's right. Well, I will say the other thing that, along the same lines, in your own book, you were one of the species that has been imported that is pretty much can be a nuisance, especially at parks, the rock pigeon. On the other hand, as you point out, they can also be a hero. I really like that, by the way, the little squib about that.
The G.I. Joe hero pigeon was a homing pigeon that that was awarded a Medal of Valor by the British government.
Well, we're visiting, our Phil Manning and I are visiting with Jonathan Aldifer, the author of the National Geographic Kids Bird Guide to North America. We'll take a short break and be right back. This is D.G. Martin. Phil Manning and I are visiting with Jonathan Aldifer, the author of the National Geographic Kids Bird Guide of North America. We've been talking about this book, Jonathan Aldifer, but you do a lot of other things up at the National Geographic. And I think one of the great things that I got to know you was a very short video on the webpage, which shows how you illustrate how you make a bird, an illustration of a bird, a painting or a watercolor. You're an accomplished artist, and would you talk a little bit about your role as an artist?
Sure. That was really my sort of entree into the birding world, is that I was an artist and wasn't painting birds particularly until I was around 30, and then got involved with some illustrations and for a local Audubon Society, actually, in Los Angeles. And it kind of took off from there. It was a blending of art and science that was really exciting to me. And as a birder, when you paint a bird, for instance, it's kind of the ultimate getting to know the bird, because you can't just paint a picture of it with words, and you have to do every feather. Or at least, you know, you have to do the whole bird, one side of it anyway. And so whether the tail is this color and that long and where the wingtip stops and how the eye is set into the head, all those decisions have to be made when you're doing an illustration if you want it to look like the bird. I mean, that's my objective, is to make a painting that looks like what you would see through a pair of binoculars, a really good view of a bird. So,
well, I wanted to learn from you about this. Phil's talked about being a part of the Audubon Society, mm-hmm. and when you read the biographies of Audubon, you learn that the way he was able to do to get such a good image is he killed a bird and then. Paint him or do the watercolor that was the basis for the wonderful colored engravings that are so wonderful.
Well, I don't do that.
what do you do?
Good for you.
It's just funny that you mentioned that, because I was just up in New York City visiting my sister who lives up there, and they have this fantastic, all the original watercolors that Audubon painted are owned by the New York Historical Society in New York. And over the next 3 years, they're going to have three exhibits, each lasting a year long, and they're exhibiting the original watercolors that Audubon painted, which are, you know, we've seen reproductions of the engravings that were then hand-colored, but the watercolors that Audubon did are just spectacular and so much better. That's what we know of him generally, but that's a little off the subject. But yes, and he shot birds, and he didn't have binoculars, or if he did, they were really lousy ones. and he actually used a board that he pinned the bird to, or sometimes he'd use string and he'd hang it from, if he wanted to paint a bird in flight, he'd hang it and from a ceiling or something and try to get it into a pose that he liked. And that's why some of his flying birds actually look a little odd. His perch birds look a lot better, I think. But that said, I don't do it that way. I use a combination of reference materials. I'm lucky to be in Washington, D.C., where I can go down to the Smithsonian. They have an incredible collection of birds. It's not really open to the public all the time, but it's their study collection. And the birds aren't mounted like a taxidermy mount. They're just sort of lying out straight. But you can check feather details and color. The colors, amazingly enough, they don't fade over. They're kept in dark drawers, in cabinets, and they stay very fresh looking. So I use that. I'm not a great photographer, but I go out and photograph birds myself. I look what else is available in photographic reference material. Do some drawing in the field, make some sketches, just mostly to try to get the way a bird poses or stands. Sometimes in a photograph you don't get a good idea of that because a photograph is a millisecond of time in a bird's life, and it might be just doing something a little odd. So it's nice to have a real familiarity with the birds you're painting, you can recognize that.
Well, we're going to post a link to that wonderful short video of your working showing a little bit about how you do it. Now, Phil and I, as we've explored and learned about you, we've found out, first of all, that you didn't just write this kids' bird guide to North America, but you've written lots of written or edited or assembled lots of other books for the National Geographic centered around birds. So I just wonder what else. I mean, you got to doing so much that I bet you're doing other things too.
Well, I do a lot of spend a lot of my time working for the National Geographic and working on their books. We also last year have launched an app for the iPhone and iPad, which takes all of the images from our big field guide and puts them into an app that you can use on your iPhone or iPad, and it allows you to search. Has a search function, so you can say, I'm in North Carolina, it's April, and the bird I'm looking at is the size of a robin, but it's gray, and you punch in those search functions and you hopefully get a short list of the birds it might be. So that was fun to work on, and you know, an app is great because it has all the sounds too. And have all the songs, which a bird book unfortunately can't handle.
Well, I'm so glad I asked that question. So, is the National Geographic is pretty good about charging for its production? Do you remember what the price for that app is? I'm excited.
Yeah, the app is $9.99.
And that takes you forever update it all the way through. You really get the benefit of going to the whole archives that you've.
Yeah.
Assembled on all of these books.
No, it's kind of a bargain, I think. There are a lot of free apps out there. And actually, we have a free app as well, a free bird app as well, just to introduce people to what the full version looks like. So that if somebody is listening and they want to go into the iTunes store and download a free app, National Geographic Birds, I think it's National Geographic Birds Lite or free or something like that. It's they can get a look and see if they like it and want to get the full.
Well, that's really exciting. We thank you so much, Jonathan Oliver, for visiting with us, and look forward to having you come down to see your daughter graduate at Chapel Hill. And Phil Manning, thanks for joining this conversation.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you, DG, and it was good to talk to to the two of you today. And I hope the people who are listening will get their kids out there and looking at birds.
That's great. And thanks to all those listeners for joining this conversation. And Jonathan Oliver, we'll look forward to seeing you when you're down here for graduation.
Thanks, DG.